Yakti culture, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Macross Speaker Podcast. Now, this episode, we've got something that we don't normally do here at Speaker Podcast. It's a recording of the US Renditions panel from Macross World Convention 2015. We had so much positive feedback after our discussion last episode and people asking questions about the panel who couldn't make it to the con that we decided just to put the audio up as is. Now, as such, it's not the greatest recording, it's a little bit distorted, but we recommend you give it a listen. It features ex-US Rendition staff, such as David Keith Riddick, Les Claypool, Victor Garcia, and others, and there are a lot of really interesting stories regarding the anime industry in the US back in the late 80s and early 90s. Special thanks goes out to Adrian, otherwise known as Save on the forums, for recording this for us. So here's the audio, pretty much as is. Hope you enjoy it.
Started out my career in anime as a fan, and I was a freshman at Long Beach State in film school, and as a fan project, I did a translation of the movie Macross Remember Love, and I was a member of the CFO, which was the Cartoon Fantasy Organization, which at that time was the nation's largest anime club, and this was pre-internet days. All the anime was that was watched and shared was done through either pen pals or through meeting at these fan club meetings, and everybody would basically bring their TV anime and daisy chain VHS machines together and make copies of it or whatever to give their friends whatever. But that's how it was. So anyway,
was anime popular in America in 1985?
You know what? It had a very small but growing niche following. Mainly people were watching shows like Star Blazers, which was the English translated Space Cruiser Yamato. And eventually, of course, the early version of Macross was part of a series called Robotech that was done by Carl Masek, right? Who was somebody I knew from that time period. He actually did the first few episodes of the original Macross series on a VHS tape called Booby Trap, which was the first three episodes, as kind of a test to see if it had a market. And basically, I was at a convention, not too unlike this one, not an anime convention, but a comic book convention. I saw a copy of that tape, and I also saw a copy of a book called Macross Perfect Memory, and that's what kind of kickstarted my intense interest in all things Macross, and basically that led me on my journey to do the translation of that movie script, which basically was just done as a fan project, just to prove that we could do it. And that script fell into the hands of a guy by the name of Kevin Seymour. Kevin Seymour was the was in charge of the animation division at a company called Books Nippon, which was a subsidiary company, large Japanese company called Nippon Chunbon Hanbai. And Books Nippon was at the time in the mid '80s was kind of like the source of Japanese animation goods in the U.S. And Kevin saw the script at a convention and said, I want to meet this Dave Riddick guy. Who is he? You know, what's his deal? Because basically Kevin and Sho Nagata and Satoshi Komatsu, who were the Japanese heads of Books Nippon, knew that with the economy in Japan the way that it was, the cost of a tape like this, if it was just like a two-hour movie, would cost you on VHS tape somewhere around $120. And that's how much you normally get like a VHS tape or a DVD for like, what, $19, which is probably closer to the price point that we're kind of trying to get to, or $30 or something like that. So basically they knew with the goods being so expensive and the demand, you know, rising largely due to the rejuvenated interest in anime caused by Robotech, Kevin knew that the future would be Nippon producing their own anime goods in the U.S., but where to start? Well, because I knew Carl Masek, we had a meeting, and we decided that we would try to do the Robotech soundtrack, because at the time there were comic books, there were books, and it, people here who know Macross and Robotech know that on both series, both versions of the series, music is a huge part of that series. And so I produced the first American BGM album, and basically what I did was I patterned it after the Macross BGM album, because I was a huge fan of anime music, particularly that mid-80s anime, that era, mid-80s anime era music. So that when that was released, that proved to the Japanese staff that it was viable to now start creating things in the U.S., because Nippon was just a bookseller. They weren't a media company. So what happened was, because we were able to do this soundtrack album, we that kind of opened the door to doing the first subtitle videos. So what happened was, for a long time after the Robotech album came out, we were trying to make contact with the Japanese anime creative community, and which was very, very difficult. Again, no internet, so it was everything's by set up by introduction and kind of a lot of dead ends and stuff. But there was one event that happened that allowed us to make kind of that first contact, which was the Victor
Garcia. Victor Garcia. Now, come on. A warm welcome for Mr. Victor Leach Garcia.
You're going to tell your story.
I'm getting to it. So basically what happened was we were invited to Grauman's Chinese Theater for the release of a movie called Wings of Onyamas, which was called Star Quest. And it was the earliest dub of that movie. That wasn't the one that we were involved with. But when we went to the premiere, I met a guy by the name of Ichiro Itano, and I also met the guys that were in charge of Gainax. And Gainax was kind of like the young upcoming anime studio in Japan at that time, kind of like the young Mavericks. And so my writing partner and good friend who couldn't be here today, Robert Place Knappen, basically said, you know what? What we need to do is make a Gainax, but in the U.S. Like that's what this new company that we're going to do should be. And I'm kind of jumping around chronologically. Bear with me. So basically, what happened was when we were going to do these early subtitled videos, such as Appleseed and Gunbuster and Gangaio, what we wanted to do was give the original Japanese creators like full credit for all the work that they did. We wanted to present their work to the U.S. market in the best, most respectful way as possible. And in the early days, those subtitled videos were done in the best way that we could at the time. However, I freely admit that there were some errors in those first steps toward what would become Ortis, Macross 2, and Guyver, and then eventually would become Ghost in the Shell, Akira, and all the things that Les worked on. So I'm getting ready to segue to Les to kind of fill that part in. So basically what happened was, after that Star Quest premiere, that kind of somewhat opened the doors for us, but we would eventually meet a guy by the name of Kenny Otomy. And Kenny Otomy worked for a company called Hero Communications in Japan. And Ken is currently in Japan right now. He should be here, but he's in Japan. So when Ken came to Books in the Pond, that was like a godsend for us, because finally we had a direct contact to the Japanese creative community. And so he was the one who was able to present to us a package of anime titles to release in the U.S. And one of the ones that we lobbied strongest for was Ortis. Carl Masick told me that he wanted to do Ortis as part of the Robotech series, but they couldn't secure the rights. But it was kind of a coup that thanks to Ken and Ken's involvement, we were able to secure the rights to Ortis. So once we secured the rights to Macross 2, Ortis, and Guyver, and those first dubs, the person that we turned to help us was none other than Les Claypool and his company, Magnitude 8. And so basically, I'm going to turn the mic over to Les so he can kind of explain to you how he came in contact with Kevin Seymour and Robert Knappen and how it all started.
They actually started those shows, the three you spoke of, at another studio, and it wasn't working out at all.
It was called The Cave.
It was called The Cave, and the booth was a cave, literally, a dirt cave down at the bottom of the house.
And remember, we would all record.
No, don't remember me. I have nothing to do with that. That's your problem. So I get this phone call before they started in The Cave. I was working on a movie called Kung Fu Rascals that Steve Wang directed, and Kenny Adomi called me and wanted to know if my studio or I was available. He knew Steve Wang. And I said, no, I'm working on this crazy movie, Kung Fu Rascals, and two of us are doing all the music, sound, dubbing all the dialogue, everything, and it would probably take us, you know, a couple more months to finish it. So we finally wrapped up Kung Fu Rascals, and I'm sitting there thinking, now what do I do for a living? Maybe I have to get unemployment. I've never tried that. I don't even know how to get unemployment. And so I get up in the morning to go figure out this unemployment thing, and it's a holiday, so I can't get any. So I gotta wait till the next day. Well, that day, I get this phone call. It's Kenny Adomi again, saying, well, are you done with Kung Fu Rascals? Can you work on this Japanese anime stuff? I'm like, well, I guess. What is it? I don't know what anime is. He's like, well, it's cartoons. That's what they call it in America. Yeah, okay. So this carload of people show up at my garage studio and have a million questions because they went through holy hell at the other studio. It wasn't really a post house. And so I believe it was Kevin Seymour, Robert Napkin, Ken Iadomi, Yutaka Maseba, and Ray Garcia.
That's right.
And they all line up in the back of my studio, and I'm leaning up against my little console in the studio, and they're just grilling me. I'm thinking I need a lawyer. Like, well, how do you do this? Well, here's track sheets. Keep track. Okay, that's good. How many microphones do you have? Uh-oh. Why is that important? I got one good one, and this is actually the one still from that day, and I still have that thing. And so I'm thinking, oh, it's unemployment, or I got to convince these guys that I can do whatever they need me to do. So I said, well, how many mics do you need? They go, well, we bring all the actors in. We just keep them here all day and line them up in front of it, and they come and go as they have a part. And I looked at them and said, why don't you just bring the actors in one at a time? It's like, Halo. So they're like, we can do that? Yeah, that's how we do it stateside. Well, in Japan, they line everybody up and they do it all at once. Not here. I just finished the movie. We did everybody one at a time. So that was one of those, like, oh, God, they're buying it. They're buying it. This is great. So they all pack up and leave, and I'm thinking, okay, got to go get some unemployment, I guess. It's not 2 minutes later when my phone rings. We've decided to go with you. We want to start immediately. And I'm thinking, where are you? Around the corner? And remember, this is the day when cell phones were like that big.
Miami Vice.
Exactly. And I think it's either Ken or Kevin calling me saying, oh, no, we want to go with you. Okay. Let's start. So some of the... And it was completely the Wild West. I didn't even know the word anime until I started working on it.
What?
And I'm... I know what cartoons were, man. I watched Speed Racer, but the anime word wasn't out there yet. So they show up with all these materials, and we're trying to fix the stuff, and it's truly, truly the Wild West back then. There were no rules. You could do whatever the heck you wanted. They didn't care. To show you how insane it was back then of do whatever you want, a lot of those first volumes of Orgus Guyver and Macross 2 had a ton of technical problems from the other studio that I really couldn't cure. I could kind of help them along, but I couldn't fix them, so I was always looking for sound effects to layer in, like birds chirping and storms and anything to cover the noise that was on the dialogue. Well, because I had just finished scoring a movie, it was actually easier for me to compose music and quicker than it was to sit there and try to put sound effects in. So if you listen to the original Guyver OVA, the first six episodes, there are all kinds of music cues in that aren't in the Japanese, and that was just me going, that dialogue's really noisy, what key is he in, is everyone else okay? I would just play something to cover the noise. There were no rights transfers, no permission granted. I mean, we just did stuff because, you know, nobody told us we couldn't. And that just sort of blossomed, and we got busier and busier, and I eventually moved in and built a professional studio, and that grew and grew, and
got to employees. And I had to hire my first employee when I was scoring Guyver Dark Hero, the live-action feature film. And that's it didn't stop for almost 20 years. I mean, that's
can I ask you a question?
No.
So, Guyver, Matt Gross, and Orgus, was that it for anime being done in America at that time?
Well, for me, I mean, I don't know what else was going on around town.
The other stuff that was being done at the time was the early dubs that we did, that we were all involved in, and then the earlier subtitle things that we did. There's another company called Anime Ego that was run by a guy by the name of Robert Woodhead, and he was also kind of in the running to be the first. He was one of the first for sure, but he was in the running with us. He was the first to do the subtitle anime for the American market. U.S. Traditions was the first, and he was the second, but they still should be mentioned here because they did a whole lot of things: Bubble Room Crisis, Bubble Room Crash, and a lot of the Otaku no Video, which is now legendary. You know, and Robert's heart was pretty much in the same place our hearts were when we did the original U.S. Traditions, which was basically present anime with respect and with full credit to the original creators.
And to finish up the historical tour of how old I am, that's the original 8-track tape deck, I still own it, that we used for all of those early shows.
Wow.
The Macross 2, the Guyver Act 2, the Orgus. We may even have started Macross Plus on that. And I can tell you, when you've got 8 tracks, and that's it, and one of those tracks is the time code, so you can lock up the video, now you got 7 lousy little tracks. You do something like Guyver, where everybody turns into Zoonoids, and there's Guyver processing and monster voices, and you've only got 7 tracks. And you've got to take each one of those and bounce them with the process over to another track, and 7 tracks fill up real, real quick. Some more original stuff, insanity from today. Kevin Seymour ended up calling this the pickle jar and built an insane collection that I still have. I'm not sure if we started this in Orgus, but we definitely did in Macross Plus when we're looking at everybody in helmets constantly. They're all in space, they're all in helmets. So way back in Orgus, I'm thinking, I have no way.
What the heck did we do?
Processing to make it sound like they're in a helmet. So I ran in and stole a Tupperware thing, you know, container from my mother, because we were in her garage. We used to rent her garage. And this will be your official helmet sound now. And that's exactly how we did that. We stood on the microphone and everybody talked into the same nasty old Tupperware container that got washed about once a month. And this degenerated into Kevin Seymour. Once he latched onto this idea, I told him, yeah, we could track it like that. I don't need to do it later. If it sounds good, sounds good. That was always the philosophy when you're tracking it. If it sounds good, it is good. He built up an insane collection. He'd come in with every size of these damn things you can think of. And when we did blackjack, he went and got hospital masks. And I mean, he's got stuff with certain hole patterns cut in them. It's like, oh, this is not just what we're...
One thing you have to understand about Kevin, and that's something about both... If for those of you who knew me back in the 80s, way back when, knew I had a pretty intense personality. I've mellowed out my older years. Back then, I was pretty... a little arrogant, kind of headstrong, and kind of, I admit it, but I had kind of that youthful hoogly thing going on.
Have you changed?
Well, I'm more chill now, so I like to think so. Anyway, but Kevin also was the same sort of way, but Kevin was kind of a quiet, but really kind of thoughtful, introspective person, but he had an alpha personality, and I had an alpha personality. And the thing about Kevin, and the thing with Kevin, that I really would just sit back and just like, this guy, I really admire this guy because every aspect of every single thing that we did, he from the cases of the VHS tape, we went to a video convention, and that's where we met John O'Donnell, who eventually made a company called U.S. Manga Corps. And actually, U.S. Renditions was cooperating with U.S. Manga Corps to do a video called Dominion Tank Police, and we helped that company get off the ground. We knew that there needed to be more companies, not just U.S. Renditions, but this anime thing was really going to take off in the United States. But Kevin, wanted to have the best VHS case, the minimal distortion, and every aspect of the case, he wanted to have a certain kind of feel to it when you open it up and the way it looked. And even with you, here's a bit of trivia that I promised Bob that I would share with you. Kevin actually, I mean, for those of you who've seen the Orgus series, you know that there's a theme in it, which is I Am a Gypsy, the Amon or Gypsy kind of inspired people or aliens, or however you want to look at it. But Kevin actually went to an actual tarot card reader to figure out what tarot cards he should put on the back of the VHS tapes. And that just shows you how he was. He was like, watching Kevin do his thing was like a performance art. I used to tell Robert, he's got like performance artist, the stuff that he does. It's really, really something else. And eventually, Kevin, a guy who started off as basically a bookseller, a book wholesaler and dealer, through discussions with me, discussions with Bob, and kind of like me explaining what my vision was for U.S. renditions and what it was going to be, eventually became one of the greatest ADR voice directors of our time, hands down. Probably the most, in my opinion, most significant. I mean, he did Cowboy Bebop, Ghost in the Shell, Standalone Complex. I mean, Les worked with him, so he can fill in the blank on Big O, all the different shows that he did. And Kevin, you know, brought that kind of wonderful obsession to detail and to the dubbing of anime. And that's why when we started with Orgus, it was at a certain level. As Les told you, it's kind of like the Fast and Loose, anything goes, Wild West, get it done kind of thing. But as time went on, as the technology became more available to us, it became, you know, the quality of the dubs became like real art. If you've ever seen Kevin's amazing Code Geass, the quality of that dub is just phenomenal and amazing. And he actually, you know, it's sad that we lost him because he died a couple of years ago. But I feel like he's still with us here today. He was a guy that believed in my vision and believed in what we were trying to do, and it was. U.S. Renditions was our vision, along with Robert Knappen, and, you know, thank God that we had, you know, guys like Les to help bring that vision to reality. And one thing I want to say before we go into speaking with the voice actors was that when we got the rights to do Orgus, I wanted to ensure the thing that I wanted U.S. Renditions to be, I thought, if we're going to do this, I want to do this next level. It's going to be different from, like, you know, just like this is your standard, you know, the actors come in and read their lines thing. I want them to feel the characters, build a rapport with the characters. And I remember talking to Tom and to Victor, who was my first big contacts, of how I wanted them to kind of understand the characters, understand their motivations, understand where it's not just reading a line, it's actually, I understand where this character's coming from, I understand the backstory. And because of that, I think those were the scenes that kind of gave way and rise to the level of anime dubbing that exists today. That philosophy. And actually, to segue to what Carl Masick was doing, after Carl did Harmony Gold and Robotech, eventually he went and did a company called Streamline Productions, which was, I believe, my opinion, that it was kind of a reaction to what we were doing in U.S. renditions, but also I believe that it was what he wanted to do all along. And he did a dub for a show called Nadia, Secret of Blue Water, which to this day I think is the best version of that dub to ever come out. So Kevin, you know, I just want to kind of hammer in again, you know, how important Kevin Seymour was to the anime community and how important he was to getting this kick-started off in the U.S.
He forced me to start mixing these shows.
Yeah.
Initially, I wasn't supposed to mix these things. We were just going to track them, and then they were supposed to go to Japan to be mixed. That was the original plan. But Kevin didn't trust that at all. You know, he saw how anal I was about every little detail of things, and we're talking about it. He's like, why don't you mix them? And it turned out Japan couldn't mix them because I have this 8-track quarter-inch reel-to-reel tape deck, and they said, we don't have these in Japan. We have no way of transferring this. And I'm like, hello, look at the label on the back, made in Japan. Why can't you get that? You guys made them. The company, the Flostex is a Japanese company. Sorry, we can't do it. So Kevin convinced Ken Iannomi that Les should just mix them all. I should? Okay. I told Ken, well, I don't have all the gear necessary to do that. And Ken, didn't matter how long Ken was in this country, his English was always, it never improved. That feels exactly the same.
Yeah.
And every sentence was three or four words max. And he would just go, Ken, mix my equipment. Ken, I don't have any money. I will buy and take out of your paycheck. Okay, I'll mix them. And that's Ken always said everything. When I told him I was too busy to do all these shows at once, his greatest quote was, simply must work in parallel. What does that even mean? Must work in parallel? Must get both shows done at once.
What?
And you know, we got along fine because somehow 100-hour weeks came along and everything got done. And he would sit behind me while I'm mixing these things. And I'd roll through and try to memorize one little scene because it's not Pro Tools, this is tape and touching in, and it's a real pain. And I'd roll through and listen to him, go, okay, this is what I'll do with that scene. And Ken's like, good, fine, moving on. That kid, I haven't even mixed the scene yet. And we would do two of these shows in one day, mix them. Now, you know, later on I was mixing, take me a day and a half to mix things. Like, Bo Gias would take me a day and a half to do one episode. But back then it was two a day with Ken sitting back there saying, that's good, moving on. That's good, moving on.
I like that.
Victor Garcia, the production manager of Macross and Orgas and Guyver. I have one question. Show of hands. Has anybody in this room seen the movie The Guyver with Mark Hamill? All right. The way this pretty much came about was there was a guy named Aki Khomeini, and Aki had a friend named Ken Iadomi who came on the set, walked around, and Ken and I got to talking. And Ken found out that I was an actor. I was an assistant coordinator on that movie. And our talks went on and on. After a couple of weeks, he asked me, well, do you know any actors? I go, yeah, I'm an actor. I know a bunch of actors. What do you need? He goes, well, we have some animated titles in Japanese that need English dubbing. So do you know anybody? And I'm like, well, yeah, I know everybody. So, you know, I go to my little, you know, my book here, and I'm trying to find some name, my Rolodex at that point. We didn't have the paper ones. And I had two go-to guys. I had Tom Fahn and Steve Bloom. And I worked with these guys for years. I knew Tom since the mailroom. That was a long time ago.
He was our boss in the mailroom.
Back in the day, we worked at Empire Entertainment, the people that did Reanimator, Zone Troopers, Tom and I.
And Steve
Bloom. And I knew Steve. That's right. So Tom and Steve, you know, I would goofing off in the mailroom and just a bunch of voices. And you know what Tom and Steve do. They do it best, and they're amazing actors. Well, I needed a female. And I asked Tom, I go, Tom, you know any women that could do this voice? He goes, yeah, my wife Dorothy. Okay, great. Well, let's talk to her. So she came on board, and she was one of our actresses, and then every one of us was doing like two and three voices. I remember one time I did a voice with a cold, and I was nasally, and it was just miserable, and I was on medication, and it was like a Zoloid or something like that, but we needed to do that. Well, we needed another young-sounding voice, and I was like, Tom, who? What do we do? And he goes, I got a brother, John. You got to talk to John Fahn. So I got a hold of John, and John's voice is amazing. You know, Hibiki Kanzaki. That's all I got to say. But I mean, and what you do is when you cast voices, you cast musicians, you cast singers, because they know how to handle their instrument. Now, Tom and John aren't singers, but they knew how to handle their instrument. Dorothy, amazing singer. And everybody was pitch perfect. We didn't have a lot of time to goof up. We had to do the tracks once or twice and then move on. There was just not a lot of time. And Les was going through it and cutting as, you know, as we moved. Then we needed another woman. And I'm thinking, and Ken told me this, he goes, we need another girl. I go, no, Dorothy, she's got to come. No. A different one, and she needs to do three voices as well. So I'm like in tears. I'm going, Tom, dude, one more woman. And he goes, my sister Melissa. And I'm like, dude, how many Fawns are they? And what are you doing? Melissa Fawn, Broadway actress, one of the leads in one of the cast members from Wicked. You know, amazing resume.
Keeping the Fawn family employed since 1992.
That's right. I had a few other friends come in, and Steve was always on his own track. Steve used to do 2, 3, 4, 5 voices. Debbie Rogers was another one. We had a Gary Dubin, sorely missed.
I'm going to interject one thing. Robert told me to tell you about Steve Bloom. There was a day when one of the actors couldn't come to record for Orgus, and we were under a timeline. So Steve actually did 5 voices,
yep.
And they were all radically different at one sitting. This guy was amazingly versatile.
We knew it when.
Yes, and one more thing on John's behalf. I seem to remember you talking to yourself. There were 2 characters you played. One,
I played a young guy who steals the Orgus, and then I also played his grandfather, trying to convince him not to do it. So it was like, but I need this. I've got to get her. You can't know that. It's like me just going back and forth with myself, which I do all the time anyway. But I mean, that was just a whole different thing.
So this is what comes so easy. But that's basically how it all came about. Then we met Les, who saved our tracks from the cave, and that's pretty much where it is. And one last thing, we desperately want, I want you guys to hear from the actors, but when the actors are done, we do have the original credits, with our credits, the song to Orgus, and we want to cue that up as soon as we're done with everyone here. So,
you're ready to take some questions.
Okay, great. So, who wants to go next? Tom, John, Dorothy?
Okay, I have one thing I want to say before we go to the
Q&A. Oh, my God.
Okay. How many people here have seen Orgus 2? The sequel to Orgus. Okay. Orgus 2 has an interesting story, and this is, I brought something with me that has been under lock and key for all these decades, and so I'm going to reveal it to you guys. Okay, Orgus 2 was something that Nippon did, and here's the original character designs, but this is not what I brought. This is one of the things I want to show you. These are the character designs that Kevin got from Yutaka for the Orgus 2 designs for Orgus 02. So I'm sure you recognize them. These were fresh before the series was done in Japan. And the hero character from Orgus 02 on LA Hero stationery. But here's the bomb I'm gonna drop on you guys, okay? The Orgus 2 that wasn't. Okay. For the first time, when Orgus 2 was, when they went, we're going to proceed with the sequel to Orgus, Robert Napkin and I were given the unprecedented chance to do a screenplay pitch for our version of Orgus 2. Okay? So Robert and I put our heads together and came up with a story which I still think ties in more with the original Orgus storyline than what was done with O2. I like it, but I'm here to talk about the Orgus 2 that wasn't. So basically, it never got made. But here's the thing. The guy that we worked with to realize the world of Orgus 2 was none other than Rick Sternbach. And Rick Sternbach was the designer of the USS Enterprise D from the Next Generation. And so Rick Sternbach was a huge anime fan that we always talked to. You know, I mean, back then, like I said, Mobius, the guy who designed Tron, you know, one of the guys that designed the costumes from Tron, was a huge, huge fan and big friend of Kevin Seymour. So when we told Rick, hey, you know what, we're trying to do Orgus and we want you to help us redesign the Orgus for a kind of a next generation OBA that we're going to do. And so Rick put his mind together with us, and we came up with this. This is the early sketches of our version of the Orgus 2 that was the transformation sequences. And here's the Bronco 4, which was going to be the hero's new character, one of the characters, fighter plane that's kind of an evolution of the Bronco 2. And basically, I'm going to show you now the final refined version of the Orgus 2 Orgroid that was going to be for our version of Orgus 2. I do know there is an Orgus 2 that's in the original Orgus series. This is the new Orgus, let's call it that. So this, I haven't shown anybody this, but This is by designed by Rick Sternbach, a refined version of the Orgus Borgoid. And this is what it looked like. And if you see, if you can see here, it has the Star Trek art theme, because he did it at Paramount, and it even has the font from Next Generation.
That's awesome.
And no one's ever seen it before.
Wow. Yeah, I'll get back to Star Trek.
So anyway, I'll be willing to show it after the panel. But anyway, the story basically was, it was a 6-part story. It dealt with kind of like the direct aftermath of Orgus 35, which I'm not going to spoil, even though it ended like in the mid-80s. I'm not going to spoil it. But it directly ties into the aftermath and the Moo and basically what happened to the world after Orgus. Have to watch Orgus and find out. And anyway, this is that story. I have a question.
Okay. What's the bid on this?
We'll be handing these out at the end of the panel.
I will make one quick comment. Before I came here, I went on YouTube, because you can watch everything on YouTube. And I haven't seen Guyver, Macross, or Orgus in 100 years, so I watched some of it. And in Orgus, my girlfriend is my sister.
It's like, Luke and Leia.
I don't think we recorded on the same days, so I'm watching. I'm like,
be professional.
Use my wife on that. What the heck?
This is a family program.
Her voice was different. But my favorite was my death scene in Guyver, and you were yelling for me. That was fantastic.
I'll share a. Is it okay if I talk? I'll share a Kevin Zemore story. There's so many of them. But when we were working on Macross together, I showed up early for my session, and he was actually recording a voice. He'd kill me if I told you this. He swore that I would never tell anybody, but now I figure it's okay. But he played this kind of transgendered friend of Hibiki's named Mosh, and it was this very strange voice, and he would talk like this. And I just made me laugh, and he's, you can't tell anybody I'm doing this voice. So I'm like, all right. But for years after, whenever he called me, I'd be like, hello, he'd be like, hi, Hibiki, it's me. I'm like, you tell me not to tell anybody this, but you're ready to do the voice always. And I have him on my headset. He'd be like, do it again, please. And I'm like, yeah. So anyway, he was a great director, awesome to work with, very specific, and had great ways of bringing out what he wanted you to do as an actor.
Kevin was a guy who was so humble, but so amazing, that he would do things under like pseudonyms, like Road Narrows or Upton S. Remington,
Quint Lancaster,
Dougery Grant, right. All of these were Kevin. It was Kevin. It was like the I Love Lucy episode where the guy has to put on all the hats. That's Kevin. You know, he's the ultimate multitasker, but also like incredible attention to detail. And basically, he refined. From the early days to now, the art of dubbing to what we now enjoy today.
Yeah, David, it's good. I've got a great Kevin pissing off one of my engineer stories. So one of the engineers that I had that was working with Kevin was totally professional. He would never talk back. He would just do his job as best he could and let Kevin do it. And sometimes, you know, we're not always all in the best of moods. Come on, you're doing this stuff for 2.5 decades. So he would keep, there's one actor who will remain unnamed that irritated the heck out of Kevin because he would just...
Tom Foreman.
You guys did, but not nearly as much as this guy.
Under the bus.
But he would do crazy things like just as you're ready to record, he's in the booth, set up, everything's perfect, get ready to push the button. Kevin, I dropped my pencil, Kevin. Okay, hang on. Kevin would have to go hand the actor his pencil. So there'd be all these little things. Well, my engineer recorded all this stuff and kept them in a little bin in rotors. Anything that irritated Kevin, he had a whole army of this stuff. And so he wouldn't argue with Kevin about things. He just kept these things. And so one day that actor was in the booth, and Kevin, they hit a line that just wasn't working. For whatever reason, it wasn't working. So Kevin's like, you know what? Hang tight in the booth. I got to rewrite this line. So as Kevin's sitting there trying to rewrite the line, you hear the actor coming through the speakers. Kevin, hold on a minute. I'm trying to get the line. Kevin, Kevin. Oh, Kevin. Kevin, are you there?
I'm telling you, I'm trying to get the line.
Kevin, and the actor is saying nothing. It's my engineer playing these little sound files. Kevin just finally, he would never snap. It took a lot to get Kevin to just, and finally jumps on the top back. Damn it, I'm trying to rewrite the line. Would you shut up and leave me alone? And the guy, the actor, the booth says, I haven't said anything. That's how he got back at Kevin. It's one of my favorite Kevin stories.
Real quick, because we got to see these credits, is there any interest in seeing a documentary on LA Hero and West Wing Edition?
Before we roll that, I got one last thing to hog this stand. This is the kind of stuff when you do this stuff for a living that you get and nobody else does. This is a Macross Plus International Edition Laserdisc that my wife got in Japan while she was flown there because she wrote Ghost in the Shell. She actually wrote all the Ghost in the Shells, all the TV series, all the feature films. So she's hanging with Otomo and the rest of the crew, and she stops in at a store and gets this Macross Plus Laserdisc. Well, Kawamori-san came to the studio, and I played Macross Plus episode 4 for him that I worked on. And if you don't know the story behind that, all I gotta say and all I can say is listen to the Japanese version of it, listen to the American version of it, and they have nothing in common whatsoever as far as the sound effects go. And there's legal reasons for that. So I had Kawamori-san in the studio with me, and I thought, out of respect, since he had no say-so in what transpired on that soundtrack, I'm going to play him our version. So I played it for him, and I turned around and looked at the couch, and he's sitting there with this huge grin on his face, and all he does is say, Hollywood style. And so I figured, well, I'm in his good graces. I got him not only to sign the laser disc, but draw me a ship and date it and everything else. And, you know, people look at some of these directors like, oh, if I could only meet him, if I could only meet these guys. Before he did this, he was chasing my daughter, who was a toddler, on his hands and knees underneath the pool table out in the cafeteria because he missed his kid. And those are the kind of things you get to have. One of the kind items when you actually work in this business. Turn it back over to her.
I just wanted to ask a question to Dorothy and my brother Tom. Sometimes we'd be under tremendous pressure to do like 200 loops in a day. And how did you handle that pressure, and how did you make it affect your character?
I would never do 200 loops in a day.
Okay, well, I do 200 loops in a day.
You know, got to protect the chords. The one thing that I love about Kevin, he's just totally easy to work with. He's a great director. And if you were not getting what he wanted, he would give you what's called a line reading. And some actors have a problem with that. I have no problem with that. We need to get through the session. Just tell me how you want me to do it, and I will love you forever. He was awesome. Did you ever do 200 loops in a session?
Working on all these things, I was always amazed how David and Les, and they all understood what was going on, and me as the actor, you drove to get there, and you get in the booth, and you're like, all right, let's go. And they're like, well, here's what's happened. The thing just exploded, and they would go into detail, and I would be like, I don't know how I'm going to play all that, but all right, let's go. Let's try, you know. And the other thing was, for a while at your studio, Les, there was no air conditioning in one booth, and Kevin Seymour, God bless him, to show compassion on the actor, you would do a line, you'd record it, and he would say, CDFA, crack door for air, because the studio was air conditioned, but not the booth. So we'd be like pouring in there, and he would go, CDFA. So you crack the door, get a little air, and then go back in. See what we went through to bring you the magic? That's it.
Hey, we had air conditioning in the control room. It's not my problem.
One thing I want to make clear, I just want to make sure everybody knows who played who in Orgas. Okay? Tom? Kay? Shia? Olsen? Right? And also, the Andy, right? Right, and the granddad. Okay, so I just want everybody to understand. And also, I know we're getting close to the end. I just want to let everybody know that our efforts continue on as far as Orgus for today, because the U.S. Renditions dub is part of a release of the Orgus TV series that's been released, thank God, by a friend to all old anime fans, Discotech Media. And they re-released the Orgus series. And this is what it looks like. Yeah, it looks awesome. And it's available now on Amazon and Right Stuff or wherever you're trying to get your anime.
The first 17 episodes have our is in Japanese and English with Anka, and then the rest of them are all in Japanese.
Right. And one thing I want to let everybody know, just a little bit of trivia, that, yeah, the original U.S. Renditions dub ended at 17, but the actual episodes 18 to 35 were written by me, and maybe if there's a continued interest in the rest of the dub, maybe they could redo it with today's technology. It would be awesome if they could show us a redub of Orgus.
You're so free?
Hey, you know what? I don't know about that, but but yeah, I just wanted to let you guys know that. And let me keep going.
Yeah, any
questions?
Yeah, I had a question. You guys worked on the Robotech soundtrack.
Right.
The vinyl. Sorry. And then you guys did Macross 2. And then there was a licensing issue after that. Because that con, Tommy Robbins, has said that they had nobody manning the register, so to speak, during that period. But being that you worked on both the Robotech product and the Macross 2 product, how did you guys go about licensing?
You know what, from a chronological perspective, when we first started working with Army Gold, we basically licensed the music for, the Robotech soundtrack that we did with the U.S. Renditions in cooperation with Army Gold. Of course, it happened, right? After that, Macross 2 came out, and when Macross 2 came out, that was before the whole legal thing about Macross and how the rights got tied up with Army Gold and all that stuff. We did, before that all came down, Macross 2 and Macross Plus had already been done in the U.S., but that pretty much terminated as far as the sequel stuff. It kind of terminated after that.
Also, I was wondering,
how do I know if that's a question?
Oh, I'm just curious, because you guys worked with both.
Right.
One was a big West license, one was Army Gold.
Right. That was more of a something that was handled internally by Nippon and LA Hero. We were more part of the creative side, not so much the legal part. If that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. Maybe just another question. Now that everything is kind of, like, Macross 2, Macross Plus, kind of still has a life on, like, streaming, how is that still possible in these streams?
Well, basically what's happened, just like that's in the case of Discotech Media, the original licensors of this are able to pass the licenses on to new distributors. And that's how. I hope I'm answering your question.
I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a shelf life to rights.
Right.
Because that's how I was able to work on Castle of Cagliostro. I mean, I did it originally. In whatever that was, 95 or something. And then I did the recent one, a complete remix with the original elements, because now somebody else has the rights, so it's all done legally. Usually it's a 20-year shelf life on a lot of these rights issues. After 20 years, the original rights holder gets the rights back, and then can resell it again to a different distribution company.
That's exactly what happened.
I just personally want to thank you for all the work, all of you've done. I mean, I purchased the stuff when it came out through a comic book store in Fontana, California called Coins Comics, and they do mail order stuff. I mean, I have the old VHS and the white clamshell. So, thank you again.
Any other questions?
You said they only were able to do 17 episodes of Orgus dubbing. When did the word come down that you weren't going to be able to finish all 35, and can you elaborate on, you know, what happened and how that affected the whole production?
basically, by the time episodes 16 and 17 were done, I directed those last couple of episodes. And then after that, there was kind of like a staff change-up because Kevin left Nippon to form a company called Animes, which was his dubbing company. And I left Nippon to become a broadcast engineer at NPR for Marketplace Radio. And Robert left Nippon to basically become a comics writer for a comic that he created called Q-Unit. And basically the band, such as it was, is kind of like the band kind of split up. But that said, the members of the band, meaning the early Earth Traditions, me, Kevin, and Robert, worked together in other configurations with LA Hero and eventually Manga Entertainment. We were acting as kind of like contractors, you know, we were working to do that. So when the work came down that Orgus was ended, I was bummed out. But that said, Ken said, you know what, Dave, what we want to do is complete the translation scripts from episode 18 to 35. We want you to do it just so we can have it. So I actually went through to get an ADR screenplay from episode 18 to 35 just so we could have it. And that was the last thing that I professionally did with Illy Hero, were those episodes. And that's kind of like where the David Riddick story ends, in a way, with what Ken did and the other things. Because there were other, the series of the Guyver, I didn't have anything to do with that. Giant Robo, I didn't have anything to do with that. That was like my exit, if that makes any sense.
And we were also busy doing so many other projects that, you know, your reaction is, well, that kind of sucks. We're not going to get to finish this series. And you've got eight other series.
Right, exactly. It was like on to the next.
Yeah,
that's where the mindshare kind of went.
You didn't even have time to think about it because they're bringing in all this other stuff. So there was it wasn't like everything stopped. It was like, okay, maybe I get to go home on Sunday.
Yeah. And we thought, at the time, we kind of thought it was a pause. Not so much an end, but just as time goes on, that pause became, well, it's not going to end. It's not going to finish it. No, it's not. But, you know, it's kind of cool. I mean, just being Macross World, what I'll share with you as a closing thing is, I'm sure as a Macross fan, you guys can all relate to the story. I never had gotten a chance to meet Shoji Kawamori until... it was at the end, when Shoji Kawamori came to the U.S. to do research for Macross Plus, they were also talking about doing a Macross live-action movie, and Kawamori was here doing the research with the for Macross Plus and the live-action movie. And so I basically was at, how I met Shoji Kawamori, I met him at LA Hero's offices in the Valley, and Ken says, hey, there's somebody upstairs that I want you to meet, and you tell me who it was. And so he led me upstairs, and he says, you know, just watch David's on, check this out. So he opens the door, and just sitting there was Shoji Kawamori, and to me, it was like, one of the coolest moments of my life ever. And so basically, Ken introduced me to Kawamori, and he was there with these two lawyers, right, who had no clue. And they were like, wow, you're really taken aback by meeting this guy. And I said, you guys don't understand, this is like meeting like Steven Spielberg or something. I mean, it's just amazing to me. And so basically I sat down at the table, and the lawyers left out of the room, and Ken said, you can talk to Kawamori about whatever you want to talk to him about. You know, like, and so basically I'm thanked him and everything for, you know, Macross. But I wanted to basically understand what was going on with the continuity of Macross. I wanted to get it right from the horse's mouth, so to speak. Is Macross 2 the sequel of Macross? I mean, is it really? Because I was getting the feeling that there was something, here's something about Macross 2. Macross 2, when we were presented the right to do Macross 2, they sent us these character designs and these mecha designs, and I kind of basically just said, okay, I'm gonna wrap it up. But basically, we jumped at the bit to be able to do the sequel to Macross, right? But basically, we were asking him about it, and he kind of hemmed and hawed about it. And then also I wanted to know, well, was the movie, the Do You Remember Love, is that the real Macross? Because everything that comes after that seems like it's patterned after that. And so, you know, we talked about that, and he kind of gave me kind of the answer. But later on, of course, as you guys know, the hardcore Macross fans, that they were able to basically state that the alternate reality theory for Macross 2 and the other stuff. So it's just something I just want to share.
One quick thing for the actors. Since you talked about, you know, forging a relationship with the characters as far as getting them to know the characters, I'd like to ask all the actors just brief observations about the characters that they played.
In 1992.
Yeah.
Since we're being nostalgic about Orcs.
Okay. Only because I watched today, I thought it was real acting for me to play a hero. But, a lot of the times, like I said, Kevin, he knew more than any of us. So he just gave us a little clue. We tried to convey the essence of it. But a lot of times I play just the smaller parts. But on this one, I was the lead part. So I didn't look at them any differently. I was happy to do the thing. Happy to do the part. I don't know if that answered, but I tried. It's been a long time.
So this happened kind of quickly. We got the scripts very fast. They were translated really quick. And we sort of had an idea of who was going to play what, based on the sound of our voices 20-odd years, you know, ago. So we were handed the script. We had to work on the weekends. So we had all week to, we had some read-throughs, generally on a Tuesday or Wednesday night at pizza. It was always a lot of fun. Oh.
It was sushi at first, and then later it became pizza.
Yeah, that's true.
And it was McDonald's, too, at time.
But yeah, a bunch of concerns. But because it happened so quickly, the actors that we had, Tom, Blue, Dorothy, you know, we've done this in the past. We sort of, there's a way that an actor prepares in terms of approach of the script. So that was kind of under our belts already. And then when we got a little bit more into it, we saw how our characters evolved. And that's pretty much how it went from Orgus, Macross, Ambassador Bagma, and beyond.
You can see during the evolution from the earlier episodes of Orgus, the dub versions, to the 17th, how the characters kind of moved into it. They got to know it, kind of like they kind of lived it through osmosis as they were going along. And then they go, you know, now by now I'm really getting the character. It kind of showed in the performance that I can do.
John? Oh, no, I was just going to say that I could say in terms of Macross that I absolutely adored Hibiki. And that when he was running, I was running in the booth. When he was, I would do whatever I could to get my character going. I was just so excited to play that type of character. And as an actor, it was a luxury to actually sit down and watch the episode together and then read through it together. Because now I'm on another show now called Naruto. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but I play Shikaku Nara on that. And I just know the character, but I never see the script before I go in the booth. And that's usually the case with, as an actor, how it is now. So it was a luxury to get to do that all together as a group, because it helped a lot.
Okay. Before we bring this to a conclusion, we have a video of the opening credits for Macross 2 and Orcus that we're going to run. So if there is anybody that's in charge of that, we're going to get ready to do that. But I'm turn the mic over to Les.
I'm just going to ask Jason if that's... Are we doing fine? I know we're a little over. We can run the video? Okay, thank you, sir.
Are there any closing statements anybody want to make?
Well, Kevin Seymour was Quentin Lancaster's
relationship. Yeah, he was.
Half those names were Kevin.
Right, that's really true. First off, in conclusion to this panel, I want to thank all of you for coming and listening to us reminisce of the early days of anime in the U.S. Everybody here, I want to say thanks for responding to my call, to coming out here and being with us today. I'm sure everybody appreciates it. Les, I want to thank you for literally all the help that you gave me in the early days. And Les was the guy who literally took me by the hand and walked me through my first voice correcting for Orgus. And for episodes 16 and 17, I never forgot. So I'm very, very grateful for that. Everybody else here, the actors, all I can say is thanks for bringing the characters that we love to life. I want to say from the bottom of my heart, and I'm sure I speak for Kevin and Robert, who couldn't be with us here today, that we appreciate all your efforts, and thank you for your dedication and for all your hard work.
Thank you, David.
Thank you to David and Jason for all of this.
For putting up with us.
For David, Les, Tom, John, Dorothy, and Victor for joining.
And that brings us to the end of another episode of Macross Speaker Podcast. As always, you can find us on the macrossworld.com forums, where we always appreciate any feedback, questions, or any other kind of correspondence our listeners may have. We can also be contacted directly at speakerpod@gmail.com. And also a plethora of Facebook groups. You can find members from the podcast hanging out there most times of day, sometimes when they probably should be working. Next episode, we'll be reporting live from the theatrical pre-screening of episode 1 of Macross Delta. That's December 26th, Japan time, so I'm hoping to get some footage up there for everyone to listen to by the following day, December 27th. This is, of course, a few days before the actual TV broadcast on December 31st. We're all really excited for that, and we hope you are too. And so with that, we'll see you again next episode on Macross Speaker Podcast.